What is up? Another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast. I'm your host, Ricardo Verendez, and I've been putting out a lot of shows, and hopefully you guys aren't sick of listening to me. But I got a good night's sleep last night. I'm rested and excited to talk to MMA fighter, a current Bellator fighter, and a guy who's inspiring people all over the world, including myself, and changing lives. Honestly, one of the greatest human beings you'll probably ever, or I'll ever have on the show, and you'll ever hear on the show, Justin Wren. I don't even know where to start. MMA fighter, dealt with depression, dealt with a lack of fulfillment in his life, went through some heartaches growing up, and then found his purpose when he took this trip to Congo, met these pygmy people, and just completely was connected and motivated to change these Africans' lives. And the story is really heart-wrenching, and we talk about it. He's also been on the Joe Rogan podcast. He's been on the London Real podcast. He's done a TED Talk. So if you want to hear more about certain aspects of his story, obviously he was on my show for about an hour. He's been on the Joe Rogan podcast a few times, and that's like a three-hour podcast. So if you want to hear more about his journey, his story, tune into that. But it was just a really awesome podcast. We connected. We have very similar parallel thinking. And it's inspirational when you get to talk to people like this and share their story about going from a unhappy, depressed, suicidal, self-medicating kid growing up to finding his purpose in connecting with these people on the other side of the world and completely different than himself. He's like 6'3 or 6'4, however tall he is, and 250, and white, long, long hair, big beard, and yet has fallen in love with these pygmy people in the Congo, and they fall in love with him. And I think it's a great story, and it's a great way of remembering that it doesn't matter how different we are from in the outside, we're all on this earth and this journey together, and we should help each other and do what we can. So I feel like I'm getting emotional just even talking about it, but it is. It's a very emotional story. And when you see the videos, look up Fight for the Forgotten, look up Justin Wren, and look up his story. Wren is W-R-E-N, and it'll blow your mind. And now he's fighting in Bellator to try to get more attention and on his journey and his purpose of trying to get clean water to these people in the Congo. It's just awesome. It's truly a noble thing what he's doing. And I can't thank him enough for coming on, taking time out of his busy schedule to share his story. And not just share his story, but share his experience. And hopefully you guys connect with that. So thanks again, guys, for listening. As you know, and I always tell you, you can go on YouTube, look up the Ripple Effect Podcast, or search RV Theory 6, and you can find the video versions of all our episodes, including this one. And in the show description, I'll have links to all of Justin's Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all the social media stuff. And so check that stuff out if you want to help. And also, if you want to see past interviews with him, just look up Justin Wren. You'll see the past interviews he's done, which I highly recommend everybody checking out after listening to this one if you're still interested in hearing more about his journey. So thanks again. Also, thanks again to all the Patreon contributors who are helping out keeping the show going, and everybody who shares and tweets and retweets and stuff. Thank you also. I really, really appreciate that. Also, anybody who rates the show on iTunes or whatever. You guys are all helping out, trying to build this ripple into something bigger. And I think we're on the path to do that. And I can't thank you guys enough for helping me build it to where I am now, and hopefully build it to something even bigger. So hopefully we're all a part of affecting people's lives. And also, the guests, the host, myself, and the listeners, everybody is growing and learning and a part of this journey. So I think that's it. I'll leave you guys with that. And in this world, we're not told we're loved enough. So I tell you all, I love you. And you'll know why I said that in a little bit. Enjoy the show. Peace. I believe in the ripple effect. usually I right when the conversation starts, I start recording just to kind of keep it casual. And I always have a fear of talking about something really interesting that doesn't end up being recorded. So to kind of keep the conversation flowing and casual, because really I started my podcast because, I don't know, like 4 or 5 years ago. No, longer than that, because I started my podcast 4 years ago. So it must have been like 6, 7 years ago when I got obsessed with Joe Rogan's podcast. And I love the uncensored, very casual conversation. And my goal was try to capture that. And because one thing I loved was hearing two people have a conversation like they would be if they were at a pub or if they're just hanging out, having a cigar or whatever. And you know, uncensored, it sounded like people that were friends of mine and our conversations. And that's kind of what I loved. And I love the fact that he had people like yourself who, I mean, I've had probably a lot of my guests have been people that I've been exposed to from his show, like Dennis McKenna and Douglas Ruskoff and Eddie Bravo all these people, which, you know, I'm a fan of and really, so I hope to do the same thing. And that's why I call the show The Ripple Effect, because kind of like yourself, I was kind of unfulfilled and really felt like, okay, what am I contributing? Like, what am I giving back? Like, okay, I go to work, I do my full-time job, I come home, and then what? Like, and now I have kids. I have a one-year-old, a girl, and a two-and-a-half-year-old boy. So that changes your perspective a little more, too. You kind of are more motivated to try to leave the world a little better than we retrieved it. But even before that, I just felt like, well, what am I giving back? I mean, I should be doing more than just, you know, giving money and or making money and then buying shit to kind of fulfill me temporarily. And it's like one of my favorite quotes. It's a name of a Hatebreed album called Satisfaction's the Death of Desire. And that kind of always stuck with me when I was a kid, because it was always like, yeah, I mean, desire is very temporary, you know, and when you buy material things, once you get it, that desire is gone. And then you start all over. So there has to be more, right? And there has to be something that's more fulfilling. And this goes to, you know, what you've learned throughout your journey is this community thing. And I've had Dr. Christopher Ryan on, and we talked a lot about community and how important looking at like these tribal people and these people who live in these groups where they don't have the material wealth that we have, but there's no sign of anxiety or depression. We have all the shit we want, but we're all, you know, messed up on pills. We're self-medicating with pills and alcohol and drugs. And I think it goes to a bigger picture and a bigger question of what's our purpose. And we get so caught up in this game of like just trying to make money, because, you know, in today's world, in our culture, like success is basically looked at. I think Graham Hancock said this. He's like, one of the problems with today's world is that we judge somebody based on what type of car they drive and not how many rides they've given with that car. And it's a very simple quote, but it does break it down pretty easily to understand that. That's a huge issue. We don't look at somebody's character. We don't look at, but you meet somebody who has money and you're like, oh, I want to meet this guy, or, oh, I want to be introduced to this guy. I mean, look at Donald Trump, for example, before he became president. Like, there was rappers and stuff who used to sing about him in songs because it was like a big deal. Like, oh, I want to be as rich as him. We looked up to him, but he's a jerk. It's like, we shouldn't look up to him. We should look up to people like you. People like you who are true heroes and really doing something to change the world for the better. Somebody who's just, it's greed. I mean, it's addiction to money. It's just wanting more and never having enough. I mean, to me, I look at that, and you've had your issues with addiction, and I always say this, and I promise, Justin, I'll give you opportunity to talk. Sometimes I go on these long rants. But
I like it.
I think the thing with addiction, and you tell me if you agree with me or not, but I feel like money is the one addiction that's socially acceptable. And not just socially acceptable, it's one that we almost look up to, because the most successful people are people who are addicted to money. They, you know, and if you look at the symptoms, they're identical to alcohol, pills, heroin, whatever it is. It's like you never have enough. You'll burn bridges with friends and family to get more of it. You don't care about morals, and money trumps everything. And it fulfills you temporarily, and then you need more. You need more. You need more. And these people who are really successful financially, they have that problem, and they have that addiction. But yet, because we've created a culture where instead of being understanding that community makes us happy, we think that material things make us happy, and a lot of it, I mean, then we can go into who's to blame for that. Is it corporations? Is it whatever, whatnot? But I think that's a huge issue. And what's your thoughts on the 1 million things I might have just thrown out there?
No, when you said that one quote, it was just awesome. You know, it reminded me of a quote. I think it's by Albert Einstein, and he said something to the effect of, "Try not to become a man of success, but rather become a man of value." And I just think that's a trap so many people fall in, is just wanting to be successful, and everyone praises success, whether it is financial success or it might be fame. You know, people are, you know, hungry and starving and striving after becoming famous and having their name out there, and they'll do anything and everything to get it. And the crazy thing is that, I mean, that's why TMZ, right, exists and all these other places. And it's funny, I've actually been on TMZ. It was a viral video that happened, and I did a live interview. And it was funny, I was in the midst of, you know, I was right after Lindsay Lohan, and I was right before Honey Boo Boo. So I was in really great company, I guess. But no, it's funny what people put on a pedestal and what they'll put up with if somebody is famous or successful or has money. Those kind of people can get away with pretty much anything and everything. Not really, but I mean, they get put up on a pedestal where they do get away with so much more than the average person would. And we make excuses. And I'm not trying to single anyone out, but it becomes a sort of a god or idol or something that we just, an addiction, like you said, an addiction where whether they're addicted to making money or they're addicted to getting Facebook likes or press or, you know, being the next hot TMZ story or whatever it is. So I think it goes hand in hand with those two, money and fame.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think that, like you were saying, success, I think we need to redefine success. You know, unfortunately, like I was saying, like today's culture, we define success by how much zeros you have on your bank account, you know, mm-hmm. and instead of looking
at how many zeros after your followers, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. And I think when people, and I think we can learn a lot from kids. And we can learn a lot from children, and also learn a lot from these people who do live without all the material things we have, but yet are happy. And you look at our ancestors. I mean, for a long time, that's how we lived. It was community. It was. I mean, I was actually born in Portugal. I came here when I was young, but my parents were born in a house with like no running water, and you know that's where I was born until we came to America. And same thing. Like I remember one day, like my dad's like, I wish I was, you know, he was stressed out with work or whatever. He's like, I wish I was back in Portugal. I'm like, Dad, you didn't have TV. You didn't have running water. You didn't. And I didn't get it. Like, and then as I got older, I realized what he meant was he left a world where he didn't have all those material things, but yet he had family was always together. You always have family dinners. He was one of 12, so it was a huge family. And so there's always people running around. They lived worked and lived off the farm. So there's always food. I come from a history of winemakers, so there was always alcohol to drink, and there's always accordion in the house. So it was always a party. And you got up when you wanted. You know when the sun came up. You at the end of the day you fell asleep, but you could have a glass of wine on your break and all this stuff. And it was a very casual type of lifestyle where today you might have all these material things, but there's a price you pay for that. The price is you have a boss that's yelling at you. You have to be on time at work all the time. You have to set your alarm and wake up at the same time every day, which is probably very unnatural. You have all these deadlines, all these bills, all this debt, and that mental stress our bodies aren't designed for. Physical stress, I feel like it's much more it deals with physical stress much better than mental stress. And that's probably because for centuries and centuries, we've had to kill something to eat. We've had to fix something if it broke with our bare hands and stuff. So yeah, I mean, I think we really do need to rethink what is success, what really truly makes us happy. And we can learn a lot from the people that you've met throughout your journey.
Yeah, man, I absolutely love that. You're pointing that out, and I can point right behind me to the picture that's behind me, and that's my favorite place in the world. It's the Ituri Rainforest deep in the Congo jungle. And just absolutely love that this place that's behind me, it's home. I can show you, but it's right here is where I lived for over a year. And man, that's actually outside of Bobofi Village. Our documentarian was able to fly a drone up over me and the Mbuti pygmies in the rainforest, and the canvas of the rainforest split up. And when they get over it, it looks like almost just fields of, I don't know, heads of broccoli, right? Or the, just for miles and miles, or as far as you can see, because whenever I fly in there, that's all you see to the right and to the left, almost like you're flying over the ocean, but it's the rainforest. And out there, man, it's so, it's mostly stress-free, mostly at all times, unless sickness. And really more than even sickness is like different rebel groups that could or could not come through there. But man, just knowing the things that they say, I love two things and maybe it'll spark something, but they taught me two Swahili proverbs. And the first one is, they taught me a lot, but just two of my favorite is, if you think you're too small to make a difference, try to sleep in a closed room with a mosquito. And I love that one. Because the mosquito makes such a huge difference, not just in our lives, but the entire world. If it's just annoying, or if it gets you with malaria, I think mosquitoes have killed more people than all of wars and all of time. Basically, mosquitoes have trumped that, and so they can make a huge difference. And so, how much more of a difference can each one of our individual lives make on the world, making each other's lives? Whether it's one life, this is the thing: we don't have to change the world; we just change one life at a time. We change the world for one person at a time, and then as we do that, it just spreads and goodness and light and change and transformation and empowerment. It just starts to become infectious or contagious. And I just love thinking of that quote. It's kind of a cheeky quote, but I love it. And then the other one is if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. And my team and the pygmies, the Mbuti pygmies, they just modeled that out in front of me. Like, they don't do things. If you want to do it quickly, you might, get on a motorcycle, get out of the rainforest, or go on a hike, or, you can do stuff quick alone. But if it's of something of value, if it means something, if it matters, it's going to take time and it's going to take each other. We need each other. That's a constant thing that they say. We need each other. And my best friend there, my basically brother, I was the best man at his wedding. I was named Benjamin Laringa Coley. And the pygmies named him Amagu Amagu, which literally means we are one, we are not different. And so I just love those kind of three takeaways, or quick takeaways of what I learned here in the forest that's behind me is, man, like, we need each other. We can make a difference, and we're all one, that's just three beautiful things that I love to live by. And I feel like my purpose in life, I just have the little saying, but I just want to live to love and fight for people. Like, that's what I want to do, live to love and fight for people. And so if I can do that, throughout my life, if that's kind of my guardrails, am I doing this? Am I living to love people? Am I fighting for people? Then I think at the end of my life, whenever a lot of times people are surrounded by so much regret, and I think there's a lot of, I don't know if they're ghosts or what, but there's so many things that are surrounding you of all the things that you could have done, the difference you could have made, the idea that you had that you never acted on that maybe no one else ever had before. The difference that you could have made that no one else had the idea of or the strength to or the love to make that difference in the life of somebody else. You could have done it. I think at the end of our lives, we could have moments like that where we're thinking, oh, we could have made this difference. We could have implemented this idea. I could have spent more time with this person. It's just like, man, like if for me personally, I think I will disarm a lot of that stuff, or I will not have a lot of regret. If I just live my life with a purpose to love people and to fight for them as well.
Absolutely. And I think I heard you after your last MMA fight in Bellator say that quote about we are one and yeah, so I it sounded familiar. And then I love that if you want to go far, go together. I actually just tweeted that right while I was waiting for you because I was listening to an old interview you did, and I remember you quoting that, and I love that quote because it is so important to, yeah, if you live alone. I mean, you look at just people who live in communities, they live much longer, healthier. There's a thing called like the blue zones when you look at people in the world who are places in the world where people live the longest. And usually it's these farmers and people who live very simple lives, but they have community and they probably eat more organic and all that stuff. But so I think it is important. I think that these type of suburbs we've created where people put their cars in the garage, close the garage real quick, don't know their neighbors. It's very unnatural and it's very unhappy.
Yeah. It's dangerous. It's dangerous to isolate. It's dangerous, and it just causes depression. It causes all sorts of crazy stuff. I mean, I think a lot of mental illness comes from, I mean, you look at, I mean, really, if we want to, I don't know if this is an exaggeration or not, but you look at what we do to people in solitary confinement and then what happens to them, right? You isolate someone and they go nuts. They go bonkers. Like so many mental illnesses happen, but then we do it to ourselves. If we want to throw our own pity party, anything like that, we go away, we lock ourselves up, we go through a brutal divorce. You know, one person gets the house and they stay there all alone and sulk, and while the other guy or whoever moves out, goes, gets an apartment, one bedroom or whatever, and now they're all alone. Now in their greatest time of need, you know, or at least one of the greatest times of need in their life, now they're all alone and they're able to isolate and just entertain themselves with their iPhone or Netflix and just binge watch things instead of be surrounded by people who can listen and who can love them and who can help them through it. You know, there's a real thing we need to do about looking at some of our problems instead of running away from them. You know, embrace them and say, how do we work on ourselves, develop ourselves? How do we get through this problem? What's the solution? And a lot of times we can't come up with that all on our own. I think there's a difference between, I don't know what it would be, but isolation and solitude. You know what I mean? Like solitude is something that we can intentionally create for ourselves, a time of rest, a time of peace, a time of reflection. And those are a time of vacation. And it might be a staycation. You know, you don't have to go somewhere. But I know most of the times for me, a time of solitude is best in nature or on a trip somewhere, some beautiful island or city or mountain, you know, being able to go get alone, but to isolate, that's whenever it's dangerous. I mean, I just think about the pygmies and how in their relationships, living in a community of 85 to 135 people, sometimes 300, but these small clusters of huts, you know, deep in the rainforest, whenever they need somebody, everybody knows it. Even if they want to go into their hut and just be away from everyone, you can only stay away from everyone for so much time because one, it's a hut that's only about 4 to 5 foot tall. That's the roof of it. It's twigs and leaves. It's the dirt. They sleep on the dirt. The fire is their blanket. I've never met a Mbuti pygmy that owned a blanket to cover themselves with. So what I mean by that is if somebody gets in an argument, it might seem nosy. It might seem, like it's not overbearing, but crossing different boundaries and people's personal space. But if there's a husband and wife that are arguing, the whole village is going to hear it, or at least their neighbors are, or a lot of people are. But it's actually kind of good because they can come alongside them and say, hey, how about we find a resolution for this? Hey, how about you not give up on your marriage or your kids or everything else? And it truly takes a tribe. It takes a village. And so they also say, and I'm sure it might be something well known, but they say it even there, you know, it takes a village to eat an elephant. And how do you eat an elephant? Bite by bite, right? It takes one bite at a time. It can look like something huge, but you know, just bite by bite or step by step or inch by inch, we will get through this, you know? And so it's just awesome when there's a chief and elders and just so much input. And I think culturally here, you know, we go to a lot of conferences, and we might go to a place of worship, or we might go to a school, and we sit in these rows, right? These universities, you sit in a row, and there's one guy that, or one person speaking to an entire group. And I just don't think that's how life is intended to be, where one person has their eyes on many, or many people have their eyes on one person. Life is done in circles, man. Life's done in community. That's how it's intended. And so we need to have discussion. We need to have an open forum to be able to, there might be times of intentional learning, but those should be short bursts. I really feel for even myself, how I grew up in school, but you know, with the kids here, and I looked at this, you know, a couple different documentaries. Morgan Spurlock did one in Finland and their education system. And I think it was Michael Moore, which was Where to Invade Next. And I thought it was just going to be bashing the States, but really it was just going around to different cultures and saying, what do we need to implement here? Where can we invade and bring some of the great aspects of their culture and bring that into ours, because we've lost our culture. And so I just was like, wow, that's powerful, showing Finland in the way they educate. You know, the teacher is the highest paid, one of the highest paid jobs in all of Finland is being a teacher. It's a harder position to get than a doctor. You need more education, you need more qualifications. And the people of Finland changed this probably like 20 years ago, but they were actually underneath us on the ranking systems and underneath a lot of different countries. But they decided to change and say, you know what? Our teachers are educating our future generations, our future president, our future doctors, our future everything are coming from our schools. So they should be one of the highest paid, you know, groups of people or jobs in our country. And I just love it because you see these teachers that are having discussions with the students and sitting in circles, and the students only come in for maybe 4 hours a day. And one of those hours is lunch, and they literally have a 3-to-5-course meal where there's a chef that prepares the meals for them, and they are served. The students don't go up to a lunch line. They sit down at a table, and there's literally like almost waiters and waitresses that are serving the kids. I mean, these are elementary and middle school kids, and they're eating healthy fruits and vegetables, and they show pictures of what kids eat here stateside for lunch, and the pizzas and the chicken nuggets and everything else. And you see these kids on camera saying, what is that? Is that food? People are eating that? Why would they serve those to the children? They showed it to the chef, and the chef literally started to tear up, like, oh my gosh, I'm so sad for those children. That's what they have to eat. And so it's just so nuts thinking, like, you know, all this stuff that we've incorporated into our culture a lot of times is just to make stuff quicker and to make more money. And it's like, man, like, we need to invest in ourselves. We need to invest into community. We need to invest into each other, and we need each other. And so how do we live a life where we aren't so independent? I think that's what, you know, we try to teach everyone, be independent, be independent, be independent. You don't need anybody at any time. And it's like, no, like, we need to be pretty much dependent on certain key people, not dependent to where it can wreck us if they get hit by a bus or something like that. But we need to bounce ideas off of each other. And we need, just like a business needs key roles for the business to be successful, like, we need key people in our lives for us to be truly successful and be balanced and to have just great, I don't know, communication, relationships. So relationships aren't valued like they should be, or like it is where I learned the value of relationships in Congo, deep in the rainforest, like learning, like, wow, relationships are truly valuable. I used to think, you know, people or relationships were disposable. Now I don't look at it that way. I'm like, man, like, this person made me better. How can I make them better? You know, how can we walk through life together? And there was relationships that might come and go in seasons of life. But let's not be so quick to just give up on people.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It's so important. I remember hearing about how when the settlers came, and then they captured some of the women from the natives captured some of the women from the settlers, and then they would go get the women And the women are like, no, we don't want to come back with you. We like the way they live. We like the community. We like the fact that we're a part of something and not just, you know, the person who takes care of the kids or cleans the stuff or whatever. And I forget which one of the founding fathers would write about it, how some of the people who would get captured didn't want to come back and he didn't understand. And I think a lot of that is what you're talking about. It's because they understood that if everybody's a part of the community and everybody feels like they're contributing something, because I think that's the other thing about our jobs today, too. It's like, you know, I think it was Henry Ford and you see it in McDonald's where it's like instead of having one person have an important job and making something that's important, you dumb it down where it's like your job is just to flip the burgers. So that way you're easily replaced, you're not that important, or your job is at the factory and you just do this one thing over and over again. So you don't feel like you're doing something important. You're not really, you're easily replaced. And you kind of, you know, it's not like back in the day when you had metal workers who really took pride because they did the whole thing themselves, or a carpenter who would really, you know, so you get what I'm saying. Yeah.
Think about that, how carpenters were so needed. And now it's everything's just cookie cutter. So where you don't need a craftsman, you don't need a master, you need a machine, right? You need a machine instead of a person. And so, man, you and I are vibing really well on this. And if you find out what Founding Father would write about that, I would love to go research that sometime. And so you can hit me up later for it, because I would love to look into that and just be able to share that with people and be like, this is why. I personally get it, because I know that it was really hard for me to come back stateside. I was thinking I was going to, you know, live there full time, and I might end up doing that one day, just going back and getting lost in the forest. But really, it's something that I found to be so valuable to me in my life. And I really felt part of something, like I was contributing there, and I get to contribute now through having opportunities like this on your podcast, on this platform. That's just amazing. Thank you to the Ripple Effect like community that supports you, man, because it allows me to give a voice to the Mobutu Pygmies, who the chief, I remember him coming up to me and saying, hey, everyone else calls us the forest people, and we love that. We are the forest people. This is our home. But we could also call ourselves the forgotten. Everyone else can call us this, but we call ourselves the forgotten. It's like, man. And he's like, we don't have a voice. Can you help us have one? And I didn't think at the time I could promise land or water or food. The farming initiatives and replanting, you know, trees and getting back acres of land and drilling water wells and teaching the locals how to do it and establishing like a local business so they can continue to do it. I didn't know any of that was going to be possible. But I just fell in love with the people there, and we had such a deep and instant connection. It was like there might have been an initial guard up right when I came in, because all of a sudden, here's this pasty white guy walking into the rainforest of these people who have never even seen someone with light or white skin before and look so different. And I'm walking in as this vanilla gorilla, you know. And so some of them ran and hid behind trees. But once they saw, like, I was there to, like, you know, just contribute and see what I could do. I was there to live with them and listen to them and learn from them so that together we could come up with the best way to love them, the most practical way. You know, we could cast a vision, but if they don't catch the vision, it's not going to go anywhere. And so how do we communicate with one another in a way of like, hey, this is what we think. Will it work? We call the spot around the campfire, we call that Campfire University as a little nickname, because that's where the pygmies take us to school. That's where they teach us so much about life, about their struggles, about their needs, about their joy, about what brings them, about hunting, about fishing, about farming, about being hunter-gatherers, about just so many different things is done around the fire in conversation and in community. And so, man, I totally miss being there. I am homesick for there, because that absolutely feels so much more like home to me than even here, which I love our country. There's some really great stuff. There's a lot of comfort, but with comfort, like basically how you're saying, like you can lose the desire to help one another, to love one another, to contribute, and to bring something to the table, and to push yourself to find a way to bring something to the table that adds value to not just your life, but to the lives of others, and ultimately to the world. So that's something I really discovered there, was like, man, how can I make an impact here? Because they're asking me to. They need me to. And so I want to play a role in that. And so, man, it set me on the greatest adventure and journey I could have ever imagined in my life.
Yeah, and how much time do you have? Just how much more time do you have? You got to go soon?
25 minutes.
You got 25 minutes? Okay, so...
25 minutes.
Okay, so yeah, because I'm like, we're gonna keep talking about referencing the journey, and we're not gonna have any time to talk about it.
Yeah.
but you just remind me of that book by Sebastian. I forget his last name. Tribe. And when he was on the Rogan podcast, his story reminded me of your story, because he talked about how for one of his documentaries he filmed these military guys, and they're in like one of the most dangerous parts in the Middle East. And, you know, these guys couldn't wait to get home. Like, it was like every day somebody could die or whatever. And then he connects with these guys after they get back home or whatever. And they're all depressed and they all miss being there. And he realized it wasn't so much about being, you know, the action or the adrenaline, but it was about being a part of something. Like, they came back home and they had to do some pointless job, like we talked about. They had to do some whatever, and when they were there, they were part of a brotherhood, a group, a tribe. And so he wrote this book about how, you know, how important it was to be a part of this tribe. And this guy, I think he's a pretty wealthy filmmaker and author, but he lives in like some small community in New York with an apartment, and he sold his big house because he was happier there. He was happier knowing his neighbors and being around people and all that stuff. So it reminds me of your story.
Yeah. Well, that just real quick, that reminds me of two things, which might sound funny bringing them up together, but two people, Jocko Willink and Keanu Reeves. Keanu Reeves, like, you know, he still rides the subway and he's given away so much, the vast majority, I think 90% or more of the money he's made from acting, he's given it away. He's like, man, I've made enough money to live like 100 lifetimes. How much do I truly need? Like, how about I just ride the subway, be a normal guy, live in a small apartment? I think he might own a car, but just the way that he lives his life, so humble. And he's not doing it to get like, you know, pats on the back. He's doing it because like, that's where he's happy. And then Jocko Willink, I remember, it might have been in his TED talk, or it might have been on Tim Ferriss when he was talking about morning routines. I just heard it a few days ago. I listened to both, so that's why I'm forgetting. I listened to all three of them. But Jocko Willink, one of the most decorated Navy SEALs of all times, but the most decorated Navy SEAL in the Iraq War. Man, he talks about how that he doesn't know he could ever get back the happiness and the joy that he had while he was in Ramadi, you know, while he was out there leading good men that were willing to lay down their lives as a sacrifice, and that the brotherhood he had. He's like, I didn't come back here and try to replace it with helping people in this business or helping people here or there. But like, when I was there, what I was doing truly mattered, and we needed each other, and we had this brotherhood. So it's either in his TED talk or his, I think it might be a clip on YouTube with Tim Ferriss and his morning routines. But he talks about that and talks about how he misses it so much, you know, being in the middle of war, where he said war is like hell, where your job is to inflict damage. And he's like, but for us, it was different. For us, we were protecting what we believe in and our homeland and everything else. But he goes beyond that, like, you know, I was just part of something. And so I really respect Jocko Willink a lot. And as a person, I know him personally. Great, great guy. And I get it though. I get it, because what I became part of in Congo and I'm still part of, I mean, we have a team that we were able to, and why I started up a water well drilling team, and I'm at the Water 4 headquarters right now. And I started Fight for the Forgotten, a foundation that's mission is to defend the weak, love the unloved, and to empower the voiceless. But Water 4, what we do is empower entrepreneurs in their own communities, because they're able to, instead of it being the traditional charity model, they're able to train up locals to give them jobs, be able to provide for their families, but to be able to do a job with so much purpose, to be able to knock out the water crisis in their own community, to be empowered to do that instead of disempowered by a charity that comes in and does it for them, who either assumes they can't do it for themselves, or wants the credit, or doesn't train any locals, or doesn't give them an option to learn how to do it, or doesn't show them how it can be affordable and how they can maintenance it. So what we believe is just opportunity is greater than charity. That charity can be great, but it has to be reserved for certain circumstances. And just opportunity is always better across the board. You know, maybe in times of natural disaster, charity, we need each other. Times of war or famine, we need each other. People with disabilities who can't help themselves, we need each other. And the charity model needs that. Maybe orphans, you know, they need some charity. But whenever it's just poverty, like, we need an opportunity. And so that's what I love, being on a mission to do that. My heart got struck for the water crisis. Whenever I was living without water, clean water, my water filters broke on me. I brought two, and then all of a sudden I was dropping iodine and chlorine tablets and literally like filthy green jerry cans of water and drinking from that. I got waterborne illness. I didn't understand that the average woman and child walks 3.75 miles in Africa to go get water. And the majority of the time, I think 90% of the time, it's to dirty water. And so it's just, it's mind blowing. But I had a little boy named Andy Bo. He was 1.5 years old that actually died while I was holding him. And I felt the life leave his body. And it was the craziest feeling. Here, we're so blind to loss and death. I mean, we feel it, but we are able to prepare ourselves for it. And for a funeral, the person's in their best dressed stuff. There's flowers all around. Everyone that comes prepares themselves for it. But a community in a village, like, it's ugly, it's brutal, it's in your face, and there's nothing pretty about it, and you can't prepare yourself for it. And so when that happened, it ripped me apart. It absolutely crushed me. And it broke me down. And I think that the rebuilding process has been, how do we equip the locals to start up a local business to solve a local problem so that it's locally self-sustaining? And so it's been awesome to see us be able to go from training 6, 7, 8 people to then hiring on 12 full-time staff to then 20 to now 32, 20 full-time, 12 part-time, but we want to bring in another 12. And they've been able to drill 69 water wells. We've gotten back 3,000 acres of land for the Mabuthi Pygmies. We're about to get 2,000 to 3,000 more acres of land. This is the first time in their country's history they've ever owned land. So it's just absolutely awesome that they own it. They'll be passed down from generation to generation. That's done legally on the local and the state and the national level. That it's complete transformation happening. And I just absolutely love being a small part of it and having these guys be my heroes that are teaching me so many different lessons about life and love. And then also being part of Water 4 Year Stateside, a small team of basically 14, 15 people that are empowering. Well, last year empowered 44 local well drilling businesses that employed 396 people in 16 African nations. They drilled 690 water wells last year alone and served 172,000 people. And so over 1 million people since this all started. But it's all about training people, you know, educating them with the knowledge in their heads, equipping them with the tools and the tools to put in their hands, and then sending them out to be the change they want to see in their own community. And so it's just been the greatest adventure of my life, just seeing these men and women. Even we have full well drilling teams of the hardest manual labor I've ever been part of, and we have an all women's team. And I'm a professional fighter, right? I am 6'3", 255 pounds. I'm 15-2 as a professional heavyweight fighter. And these women are doing the hardest job I've ever been a part of. And they're leading the way in their local community, giving hope to the people that receive water. Like, wow, look at what they're doing. What can I do too? You know, and inviting them in on the process.
Well, one thing when I've heard you on other interviews talk about the amount of people who die just because they don't have clean water. And I think the unfortunate thing is, And you want to talk about weird references. To quote Stalin, he said, if one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. And I think, unfortunately, that's the way we look at it, is that when it's one individual person, when we see one, then we can emotionally get involved. We can connect with that story, that person. But when we just hear a huge number, it's just a statistic. We don't connect with it. And I think that's the issue. When we hear about how bad things are in Africa and Congo, a lot of people just kind of brush it off. And it's no different than when Nancy Grace used to have some cute little white girl missing and everybody used to go fucking crazy. And it's like, you know, why? Because they would tell you the backstory. They would tell you, show you pictures so people would connect with it. And the other thing that what you're talking about reminded me, and it's a documentary that I actually have reference on the show too, and I know you have in interviews, is Poverty Inc. And you know, which is really important. I think you also talked about a book, When Helping Hurts, which is a similar type of thing.
Yeah, it basically just talks about how we can blindly think that we're doing it's the kind of American way, the microwave approach. Like, how can we do this quick and easy? And so that's sadly what's infiltrated and become the norm in the charity model, is what can we do quick and easy? How do we just throw money at the problem? How do we just give them something? How do we announce our arrival with a parade? How do we throw a party, get a bunch of smiles on people's faces, get some pictures, and then be able to leave and feel like heroes? And it's like, man, like When Helping Hurts really breaks it down to like certain situations, and same thing in Poverty Inc. It's like, if we use the show up, blow up, and blow out of there technique, it's going to fail, and it's going to hurt the community more than help the community. And so how do we do long-lasting change? Well, it takes a lot longer. It's harder. You have to invest in people, and you have to find the right people with the right hearts in the right places. And that's a tough job. But like, if you're not going to do it that way, that approach, then don't do it at all. Man, that's so nuts. And even thinking of that Stalin quote you just said, like, it blows me away. It blows me away that, I'm almost getting emotional. Like, 3.4 million people a year die of dirty water, and 2 million are under the age of 5 years old. 2 million are children under the age of 5 years old. And that's just a statistic, right? But if I can tell you about Andy Bo, or tell you about Babo, who was only about 9 months old when I held him as he died, or Kaptula Sengule, or Little Mo, these people that I personally knew, like, it wrecked me, it tore me apart. But here's the difference, I think, is a statistic that you hear about is going to go in one ear and out the other. But whenever you see it, it'll start to change you, or can change you. But whenever you feel it, whenever you're a part of it, I think that does change you. It sinks in from being a head knowledge that maybe a statistic sticks with you for a week or two, or maybe it sticks with you and it's just become head knowledge, but it doesn't ever sink down into your heart, unless you intentionally want it to, unless you intentionally invite it down from that head knowledge, 18 inches, 24 inches, the toughest distance to travel sometimes is that distance between the head and the heart. I don't know where I was really going with that, except for it just blows me away that statistics can go in one ear and out the other. But then when you see it and feel it and live it, it sticks with you forever.
I mean, just being a parent, and I mean, that just gave me goosebumps just hearing the statistics, because I think one of the scariest, biggest fears, biggest nightmares as a parent is not being able to help your children, because that's your one job, is to give them shelter and make sure they're safe. And when you can't do that, there's probably no worse feeling. And, you know, I can't imagine these people who have kids dying just because they don't have clean water. So I wanted to get into some of your depression, but we probably don't have time, because I love the fact that you're outspoken about that. I just did a podcast with Chris Bell, who did Bigger, Stronger, Faster.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
He's also a big fan of kratom, which is a natural plant which has been helping tons of people with depression and anxiety and helped him. So I had him on to talk about that. And I love people like him and yourself who talk about it, because I think a lot of times people are embarrassed. They don't want to talk about it. And then when they hear stories like yours, they feel like, oh, shit, I'm not the only one who have been through similar things or have had those thoughts or have self-medicated or whatnot. So, but if we have time to talk about that, great. But if not, then I definitely want to get into how you got into from just growing up, being, you know, a wrestler, all this stuff. And how did you even get involved? Because, I mean, some people are just like, okay, like you said, you're so different than the people you met. How did that happen? How did that connection happen? How did you end up in the Congos meeting these people who you both have changed each other's lives forever?
Yeah, well, there's a lot to break down there. But one, I probably need to go watch that Mark Bell podcast and see what Kratom's about, because I haven't really heard much at all on it. So I'm going to go check that out.
I'll send it to you. You could either listen to mine or you could listen to Rogan's, because he was actually on Rogan's for the similar reason, just talking about it. And and that's what I love about the show. I get to share something like his story or your story. And I actually had my sister-in-law who's on the show and dealt with depression and anxiety and has a history of addiction in her family. And Kratom has been a lifesaver for her. So it's
okay. Well, I'm going to do some research on it for sure. I'll watch this podcast. Maybe Joe's too. Can't go wrong either way.
So, thanks.
So just double up. And then, so I guess my depression started when I was young. My first day of school at a new school, went to a private school and didn't click, and my parents moved. And in third grade, I got into my first fight, but I didn't punch back. I was only being punched by several kids. One kid in particular, but then a couple other jumped in, and that was just third grade. It seems nuts that that can happen then. But I became very timid. I had a speech, impediment, but I had a speech therapist because I couldn't say certain words, and had a little bit of a stutter. But really the big thing was, like, I couldn't say fish. I would say, as hard as I tried, it would be fush, you know, fush. No matter how hard I tried, it would be fush instead of fish. And so it made me quiet. It made me timid. And it also made me a target. And then the bullying just continued. It got really bad. Don't have a lot of time to go into that, but just invited to parties that I thought were a costume party that really wasn't. I was the only one that dressed up and got crushed by my middle school crush, and was told at that party, this is at 13 years old when I afterwards was clinically diagnosed with depression. But I was told, I can't believe you thought you were good enough to come in here. That was my middle school crush. Next to her, the guy said, you're worthless. So I felt worthless. And then my notorious middle school bully, also shared the same name as me. He said, you should just kill yourself. And so when you're 13 and you're already gone through, probably 5 full years of bullying, sitting at the lunch table, being pelted in the back of the head with chocolate milk spit wads or fist, you just learn to think, why am I different? Why do people not like me? I shouldn't like me. Why, if they hate me, I should hate me. And so it was really, really tough. I found a little bit of an outlet with wrestling, it numbed me to it for a while, except for the first year or two, because I was the only wrestler at my high school. And so then we didn't even have a wrestling program, so it's called faggot all the time, and why are you like touching on all these boys, and just different stuff. Had my nipples twisted, fat grabbed, always in front of the girls mostly, and especially girls if I had a crush on them. It seemed like it always happened in front of that one, you know. I found wrestling, and it was my escape. No one at my school did it. Then I transferred schools. I had 2 Olympic gold medalists as my high school coaches. They started mentoring me. They made me into a 10-time state champion, a 5-time All-American, a 2-time national champion. Out of high school, I was one of 2 guys transferring. Instead of the university, I went straight to the Olympic Training Center. I traveled internationally wrestling. But just like what you were talking about earlier, like it not fulfilling you, my childhood dream became reality, because at 19 years old, I wanted to be, at 13 years old, I wanted to be an MMA fighter. when I was going through the bullying and I found MMA, I was like, I bet those guys don't get bullied. Like, that was the thought I had. And then the second one was, once I started watching it, I was like, wow, I love the human chess match of this. What initially drew me to the sport that I still compete in is, I bet those guys don't get bullied. And so at 19 years old, I had my professional debut. At 21, I got accepted onto the Ultimate Fighter TV show. I was one of only like 3 or 4 guys that didn't have to try out. While there was over like 1,000, I think probably like 2,000 people trying out for the show, they were all professional athletes. And I was one of like a handful, and I was the youngest guy selected on the show. It's the youngest guy on the at the biggest height of the career or platform, you know, the pinnacle of the sport, and just got crushed, man, because it didn't fulfill me. And what did fulfill me was at 23 years old. Well, this didn't fulfill me, but at 23 years old, through addiction and depression surfacing back up. Man, I missed my best friend's wedding, not just being there, but being his best man. And I found that out through a voicemail after going on an 8-week binge where I was literally a missing person. My best friend didn't know where I was. My parents didn't know where I was.
You're lucky to be alive.
What's that?
Lucky to be alive.
I know, man. I was hitchhiking from drug house to drug house. And that voicemail scared me sober. And I hitchhiked back to Denver. I didn't even know where my car was. It took me like a week or so to find my car. A week after I was missing for like 8 weeks. So I don't know when my car ended up in that place. But anyways, after that, I just, once I sobered up, once me personally, I mean, I don't push this on anyone, but once I found my personal faith, just a relationship with God, like it gave me something to live for. And I felt like all it was to love people, just love people. and life will be different. And so that's the journey. I heard a quote that said, I think it was Aristotle, and it said, no matter how, no act of kindness, no matter how small, ever goes wasted. And that started me on a journey of volunteering, from a children's hospital to a drug rehab, to after I was sober for a bit, to a homeless shelter, to at-risk youth, to just doing all this different stuff until, and so it's way too long to get into, but the story of, and it seems like this, you'd be open to hearing this, but I actually had a literal vision of myself in the forest and ended up there 3.5 weeks later, and 100% of the vision came true, and discovered my second family there, and just decided like, hey, these like people are worth fighting for. But the Pygmies now have adopted me as family. They literally named me Ephaosa at first. Ephaosa means, and that's the one that's most important to me, that means the man who loves us. And I take that, you know, I just love them, and we're in relationship and we're family. Other people might not get that, but it's a heart knowledge to both sides that we truly are family, even though we look so different. But then everyone else calls me Mawikimong Bo, and that means the big pygmy. And so the average height for the Pygmies is only 4'7". And me being a 6'3" vanilla gorilla, they call me the big Pygmy. And so it's just been, man, life is worth living. And I think if we can just live to love, it's only natural that we will love the life that we get to live, this one life that we get to live. And so let's have our priorities straight. Let's not just live our life to love our life and to get, and to push everyone else out. This is my life, and I got to be selfish, and I got to get what I can get. And why am I not loving my life? And why am I not happy? It's like, why am I struggling with this? Why am I struggling with that? I think Tony Robbins has an incredible quote, and I might slaughter it, but I'm going to try. But it says, the reason you're suffering is because you're focused on yourself. if you just take your focus off yourself, or at least so too much focus on yourself, you will alleviate so much of your mental suffering, at least the depression and everything else. And so, man, all we got to do is live to love, get our priorities straight, live to love, and then it's only natural. You're gonna, yeah, just enjoy life. And so, and how do we fight for people in the process?
Yeah, it sounds simple, but it's funny because Tyrell Ventura, who is the son of Jesse Ventura, they've both been on the show, And Tyrell says at the end of his show, he has a show called Watching the Hawks. At the end of every episode, he says, in this world, we're not told we're loved enough. So I tell you all, I love you. And it's a simple little thing that he says. But it, I love hearing it because it's like, it is this thing where we need to hear it more. And we, it sucks that it takes Christmas every year to remind people how better you feel when you're giving than receiving. And it's almost like all year we forget how good it feels to give people stuff. And then Christmas comes around, you're like, wow, I really like buying shit for people. It's like, yeah. Well, you can have that all year round, you know? And
yeah. Well, I have a post on Instagram. I think it's the most recent one right now. It's on there. It's going to be towards the top, but it says something like live to give on it. And it even has these facts about, the people that are takers, are actually some of the most unhappy people. And then there's the matchers, the people that try to match the takers or match the givers, and they feel lost. But the givers, they know who they are and they know that they're living a life, of meaning. And so I think we should all try to go from being takers or from just matching whoever's around us, being like a social chameleon, you know, you just being whatever this person needs you to be in front. Just be you, but be a giver, you know, choose. I'm going to give. I'm going to give my life to others. I'm going to give myself to others. And I'm not going to shy away. I'm not going to be timid. I'm not going to crouch back and hide. I'm going to be me, and I'm going to love a lot of people.
Thank you so much, Justin. This has been an amazing conversation. I can't thank you enough for the work that you're doing, the people that you're affecting, and your story, I think, motivates people like myself. And you've created, you know, this show is called The Ripple Effect Podcast because I keep trying to put the idea in people that we can all start a little ripple, and you never know what it turns into. And you are a perfect example of that. And so I can't thank you enough for being on. Where can people help? Where can people get more information?
Yeah. So if people just want to follow, it's at The Big Pygmy, PYGMY, on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. It's Justin Rin. Probably the best place, home base, is fightfortheforgotten.org. And if people want to financially give, that is truly what empowers us. It's the fuel in the engine. And we use that to empower others. You can give a one-time gift, that's great, but we've actually been building this team out called Team Watermark, and it's to make your mark on the water crisis, and that's our monthly giving club. If someone decides to hit donate, they can do one-time or they can do monthly. That's Team Watermark, and a gift, it can be really big for many, but it can be doable for most or a lot, but $25 a month, five lattes or something like that, but $25 a month over the course of a year will transform the lives of 15 people. And they'll have access to clean water for the first time, even wash training, latrines for the first time, toilets, soap, hand washing stations to keep themselves and their kids clean. It just changes the game for 15 lives. And so, that's probably the best way people can get involved, but no pressure there.
Yeah, no, definitely. You ever hear of that soccer ball that you kick around that generates electricity?
I have. I haven't seen it yet, but I haven't actually held it. But that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I love things like that that could really change people's lives. And if money was, you know, used to do things like that and help people instead of just create more wars and convince us to buy shit we don't really need, then I think the world would be a better place. But I've already taken up so much of your time, Justin. Thank you so much.
I appreciate you so much. Thank you for having me.
Hey,
truly, this has been an honor.
Hey, thank you so much. Once the show's up, I'll send it to you. I'll send you all the links, and I'll send you the links to that other stuff we talked about in the show. And
thank you, please.
Absolutely. Keep in touch, Justin. Take care, and keep up the great work. I really, really appreciate your time and what you're doing. I think you're inspiration to me and everybody listening.
Hey, thank you so much. I hope your listeners continue to support and to share and to allow this ripple effect to continue, because that's what our life should do.
Absolutely. Thank you, Justin. Take care. Keep in touch.
Yep. Thanks.
Yep, bye. I believe in the ripple effect.